U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Nancy Pelosi's January 6th committee kicks off with testimony from law enforcement officers as a Trump-endorsed congressional candidate loses in Texas. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnist Bill McGurn and editorial writer Manet Ukweberua. On Tuesday, the House committee investigating the Capitol riot heard from four officers, two with the Capitol Police and two with the Washington, D.C. Police Department. One of them said that the riot was like, quote, something from a medieval battle. We fought hand to hand, inch by inch to prevent an invasion of the Capitol, unquote. He said he remembered thinking, this is how I'm going to die defending this entrance. There was some body camera footage shown of this officer who was dragged into the mob. And at one point he shouts, I've got kids. Bill, it was quite an emotional scene. I wonder what your reaction was to the hearings.
Yeah, well, my reaction was it was an awful day for America to watch it. I remember watching it and, you know, feeling disgusted. There's no way to justify, you know, breaking into the Capitol, and especially the people who were reported to be going after Pence, looking for Pence to punish him. And we don't know what would have happened had they found him. So I don't think anyone denies that it was an awful day. I do think that the first question you have to ask yourself is the purpose of this commission fair? In other words, is the commission really designed to get to the truth of that day in a fair and impartial way? And I think the answer to that is pretty clear, absolutely not. So, you know, while I wouldn't deny any of the experiences, people, you're in the middle of a mob, it's really frightening and so forth. I do think there's an effort by Nancy Pelosi both to exaggerate the danger, like the threat to American democracy, as well as to liken it to 9/11 and all these other incidents, and even to liken it, saying, you know, the Capitol has never seen, you know, the Capitol has seen people killed there before or shot at there before. My own view is I would like it if we could have some kind of commission that would give us some facts. I would like to know about the people that planned to come there, you know, even before, you know, before listening to President Trump speak and so forth, the people that had planned to do some of this mischief and damage. I'd like to know about that. I'd like to know who they are. I think, unfortunately, instead of Congress doing its job here, we're going to have to look to the arrests and the court records and the testimony to find, to try to piece together what happened. I don't think there's a chance in hell that we'll get any kind of fair assessment that day. I think this is a political effort to paint all Republicans as insurrectionists and to use that, because I think Mrs. Pelosi intends next year again to run again against Donald Trump to keep her majority in the House.
Well, on the matter of the language, insurrection, coup is the other one that I keep hearing. I mean, I agree with Bill here that a lot of that is overwrought. I mean, there were some people who were at this riot who were fueled by falsehoods about the election. Maybe they thought they were going to stop the transfer of power somehow, but there was no possible way that that was going to happen, in my view. I mean, the electoral votes had already been cast in each of the individual states. Vice President Pence had publicly said he did not have power to refuse to count any of those votes, to reject any of them. I think that's a correct reading of the Constitution and his role in this process. So that was the right thing to do. And beyond that, Manet, it seems to me that the courts and the public would not have allowed any overturning of the election. So, I mean, that's why I at least keep calling it a riot.
Yeah, riot seems like an accurate word. I agree with both of you, and just remembering how sobering it was to hear the accounts from these officers at the first session of the testimony yesterday, and kind of cut through some of the politicization that we've seen on both sides, people trying to spin the events of January 6th to whatever kind of they think is most politically expedient, and just remember how violent the actual presence of some of these protesters was when they were able to breach the Capitol, and knowing the number of people who were in harm's way trying to defend legislators and keep the process running smoothly. But at the same time, we know that the purpose of the commission basically is to resume the Democrats' project of attaching that riot on the Capitol to the Republican Party as a whole, and suggesting that there really was a risk of basically obstructing the democratic process in a way that would actually delay or halt the certification of the vote for President Biden. That was never really quite at risk. And so we can only hope that the testimonies of the people who were involved at the time will show that on the one hand, yes, we did see a violent encounter here, but will undermine the Democrats' efforts to basically turn this into a narrative that can actually suggest that the presidential process was threatened.
But it seems to me that the trap that Pelosi and this committee is also setting is inviting Republicans in the House, in the Senate, candidates to essentially minimize what happened on January 6th. Trump has tried at points to do that. I think it's a mistake for other Republicans to follow him down that path. And so far, Republicans are kind of focused at deflecting, talking about security failures. I think that's fair game. I think the committee ought to look at security failures, why the Capitol wasn't better protected. I mean, to me, it was a surprise on January 6th that an exterior window in the U.S. Capitol, that it's possible to break that. I'm surprised those aren't bulletproof glass, reinforced, super hardened materials. But at the same time, so here was Elise Stefanik, the number three Republican, at a news conference before the hearing. She said, quote, "The American people deserve to know the truth that Nancy Pelosi bears responsibility as Speaker of the House for the tragedy that occurred on January 6th, unquote. And Bill, I guess the argument I'm trying to make here is that I think by refusing to acknowledge Trump's role in spinning these elections conspiracy theories, calling rallygoers to the Capitol, it's falling into that trap. I think that's going to be, median voters will see that as untenable.
Yeah, I mean, I think to defend Elise Stefanik, I don't think that what she said is necessarily wrong, that Nancy Pelosi bears some blame. Look, a lot of this effort has been to blame Donald Trump and to say that he instigated this. I'm not sure that's technically true. I don't think he helped. I think Donald Trump's fault lies more with after the events, you know, trying to defend it and so forth, or downplay it. But look, I would say while that is a risk, I think the far greater risk is, what is the dominant narrative in American life today? And the dominant narrative is that Republicans were leading a coup there, that everyone that came was a white supremacist or something threatening democracy, that our country was a danger. I mean, this is the drumbeat. This is what Mrs. Pelosi wants to come out of that committee. So I'm equally concerned. It was an awful day. And there was a lot of ugliness there. I mean, I can't imagine anyone justifying breaking through a window at the Capitol, any kind of violence, or even just going where you're not supposed to go. However, I think what we're faced with now is this deliberate attempt, like, I mean, to tie it to 9/11. And these aren't fringe people saying this. These are some of our leading politicians and saying, and I think that's at least an equal danger. And I think that is the specific goal. As I say, I think the other tragedy is that we're not getting a real commission to look at it, like the 9/11 commission, which I think, you know, fairly tried to do its job and assess things, because I think we could use answers, you know, non-emotional answers, not just on how bad it was, but where the faults were, without necessarily looking to assign blame, but to try to identify weaknesses, and so that they don't happen again, and so that our Capitol isn't vulnerable again. And I think this is Speaker Pelosi's great disservice. Everything she touches, she politicizes. And I think that what's dominating her moves now is to create a narrative, to paint all Republicans as insurrectionists or white supremacists. And I think that's an ugly thing, too.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. So before the break, Bill made the point that maybe part of Trump's responsibility here is what happened after and during. To me, that's still one of the major holes of information here is why what his reaction to the riot was, why it took so long for reinforcements to arrive. And the committee at least says that they're going to go after this kind of information. Here's what Chairman Benny Thompson said. Quote, anybody who had a conversation with the White House and officials in the White House while the invasion of the Capitol was going on is directly in the investigative sights of the committee, unquote. And Monet, that's interesting because that includes members of Congress. Reportedly, House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy had been on the phone with Trump that day. And so it raises the possibility of an interesting spectacle of the Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy testifying essentially on what his conversation with Trump was that day before this committee.
Yes, well, I think on the first hand, we have to say that the effort to get the information about who President Trump was talking to on the day of the riot and the process by which he decided to respond is entirely legitimate and very important. It really is surprising how little we know about some of those conversations. There were reports that day and the day after that there was a delayed response, and people suggested that President Trump might have dissuaded certain security officials from responding in overwhelming force in a way that could actually put an end to the riot. If that's true, and to the degree that that's true, we do want to know. And so it's completely legitimate for Democrats to be seeking that sort of information. On the other hand, you definitely don't want to see elected officials being hauled in, subpoenaed, and made to testify in front of the cameras, being put on trial essentially by this Democratic committee. Because we know that they're committed basically to sort of exaggerating the role that elected officials played in organizing the riot when there's little evidence that any of that took place. And what they're going to do is try to force these people to disassociate themselves as much as possible from the rioters. And essentially, it will devolve into a show trial. And I think, frankly, it would be a political misstep by the Democrats to take that step. I mean, we saw in the first impeachment trial of President Trump that American viewers, sort of moderates, are not particularly interested in watching what is essentially a show trial with a predetermined outcome. And so when your only goal is to score political points by putting your opponents in a tough position, that is going to make for exciting TV for the progressive base, but it's not really going to shed much light on the actual important background facts of what took place on the day of the riot.
Well, it's interesting because the committee could subpoena members of Congress, but they could also subpoena White House aides, people who are not members of the opposition party, or at least are sort of nonpartisan civil servants. I mean, Bill, what's your take on this? Do you have any hope or even what are the chances that this committee sheds any more light on what actually went on in the White House that day?
I think we might unearth certain facts, but again, I go back to, I think the purpose of this committee is nakedly partisan. I think Mrs. Pelosi has signaled that from the start with the constitution of the committee, the rejection of other voices on the committee. You know, you mentioned getting White House figures. I'd like to know, were there any conversations between Mrs. Pelosi and the Capitol Hill police? She has a lot to say with how they're deployed. We know that Pence called and I think he was asking for National Guard or military forces. I think he spoke to the defense secretary. I'd like to know a little more about that. I mean, I think there is a crying need to know a lot of these answers, but it shouldn't be one-sided. And I don't think there's any chance that this committee will be seen as honestly answering or even attempting to honestly answer those questions.
The committee does have two Republicans on it, appointed by Nancy Pelosi, They are, of course, Liz Cheney. We've talked about her role in the Republican Party here a bit. And the second is Adam Kinzinger, this congressman from Illinois. Here's what he said in accepting the committee role. Quote, "I'm a Republican dedicated to conservative values, but I swore an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. And while this is not the position I expected to be in or sought out, when duty calls, I will always answer," unquote. And Monet, this has made for some interesting Republican infighting. Kevin McCarthy has called these two Pelosi Republicans, and there are now seem to be some efforts to exile them, essentially. One House Republican tweeted this, "Rep Liz Cheney and Rep Kinzinger have effectively removed themselves from the Republican conference. We should help them out the door by formalizing their departure," unquote. Monet, I wonder what you make of that kind of an effort.
Well, I think the question ultimately is sort of how much disagreement should the Republican Party be expected to tolerate? I mean, on the one hand, I think that Kevin McCarthy and some of the critics of Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger are completely right, that basically these two members of the Republican Party are basically lending themselves to a Democratic cause by serving on this committee, which, as Bill has mentioned, is intended basically to paint the party in a bad light and to exaggerate the impact and the designs of the January 6th events. And by sitting on that committee, they're going to be lending a veneer of bipartisanship to it, which is unfortunate because it would be much better if the media weren't able to say that this is something that's backed by members of the Republican Party, if it was clear that it was solely a Democratic Party effort and wholly political. On the other hand, though, I do think that although it warrants harsh criticism from Republican Party leaders and members, it doesn't quite rise to the level of formal censure or loss of responsibilities. It seems to be a step too far to suggest that they should lose their committee assignments or any other formal privileges of that kind. I think it's in the nature of a party to always have sharp cleavages in it. And so I hope that Republicans continue to make clear that they're dissatisfied with the choice of Kinzinger and Cheney to serve on this committee, and that they really are undermining the party's sort of public image by doing so. But on the other hand, I doubt that the party will actually go through with the process of denying them formal privileges.
Part of the question, it seems to me, not only related to this committee, but also just Trump's fading a little bit as he, you know, now that he's out of the Oval Office, as the months continue to wear on. I wonder if any of that will diminish him as a force in Republican politics. And on Tuesday, there was a special election for a House seat in Texas. Jake Elzey was a Republican candidate, defeated Susan Wright, who's a Republican candidate, in a runoff. And the losing candidate here was Trump-backed. Before the vote, he said, "Susan has my complete and total endorsement. She will never let you down." Trump super PAC reportedly put $100,000 into the race. I mean, Bill, how much do you take this as a signal for where Republican politics is going?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, I have thought that President Trump diminished his brand right after the election, when we had the two Senate seats to run in Georgia. And I thought that was his moment to say, I might be out of office, but I can still do things for the party by electing the two Republicans. I don't think they were the greatest candidates in the world, but I think in Georgia, they were fully electable. If Donald Trump had put the effort into it that he puts in other things. Now, he did make a token effort. He went down there, I think, twice, had some rallies. But the price of that was to force these people to accept Donald Trump's version of the election, that it was stolen from him and so forth. I think he'd be in much stronger position today if he could show positive developments that he could get someone elected. So I think he diminished that at that point. And I think President Trump's mistake has been since the election, and this is in sharp distinction with his run in 2016. In 2016, he ran, had various positions, many of which I agreed with, some of which I didn't, for example, tariffs and such like. But I think he ran on an overall thing is that Washington's forgotten you to the ordinary American, and I'm going to stick up for you there. and I'm going to do certain things. And he did a lot of what he promised, whether it was moving the embassy to Jerusalem, going after China, whatever it is, even if you disagree with it, he followed through. And I think a lot of Americans, ordinary Americans, felt, here's a guy that actually cares about us and sticks up for us. Now, I think his behavior since the election, his campaign has been incredibly different. It's been very personal. Like, look what they did to me. They stole the election. Even if you think the election's stolen, is that really the theme that's popular? Like, are you going to grow a movement for another presidential run based on the personal grievance? What I don't see Donald Trump saying, and in fact, it was missing from a lot of his campaign in 2020, is what another term of Donald Trump would mean for you, ordinary American citizen. So the bottom line is, I think there'll always be some core supporters of Donald Trump who share his view that he was robbed unfairly of the election and will stick with him for that. But I think if you want to be a president, and remember, just in the popular vote, Joe Biden, I mean, I didn't vote for Joe Biden, but he defeated Trump pretty handily in the popular vote. I think that's a real uphill climb to try to reverse that based on a campaign rooted in just your own sense of what was taken from you. And not, I mean, he hasn't even cast it as what's taken from the American people. I mean, if you were going to make that your grievance, you'd say, you chose me and they took it away from you. But it just seems very personal. I think we saw that right away in Georgia. And I think, you know, while he'll still have a lot of influence, this really saps a lot of that influence.
I take all those points on board, Bill. I mean, I remember during the 2020 campaign, I was waiting for Trump to release the second term agenda, and he eventually put out some very nebulous bullet points. But it was in huge contrast to Biden, who was rolling out these 50-page policy platforms. A couple of caveats I would add on this Texas race is that it's a special election, so turnout is low. And there were two Republicans on the ballot, so Democrats didn't have a candidate to vote for. Maybe Democrats and independents voted against the Trump-endorsed candidate in a way that won't hold for future elections. But Manet, I mean, it does strike me that it shows there's a path forward for Republican candidates running for the House or the Senate, and that path doesn't necessarily require jockeying for a Trump endorsement.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's certain that Trump's influence over the party, both in primaries and also in the positions that elected officials take, is going to decline gradually as time goes on, in part because Trump has been shunted out of the limelight now that he's no longer on these social media platforms. So you can expect to see more and more candidates kind of testing his influence, defying it in small ways, and seeing if they're still able to be successful and not immediately get chopped down by primary opponents who are aligned with him. But at the same time, I do think that it varies place to place. I mean, there are definitely certain parts of the country and certain regions within each state that are much more closely Trump aligned and others that are less so. In this particular district where we had the special election, it was one that Trump only carried by 3 points in 2020 over Joe Biden. And so it's not necessarily most representative of a Trump stronghold. And so we might see kind of different parts of the party start to diverge as time goes on, with some people still betting, probably reasonably, that their best chance of success is associating themselves closely with the former president, and others who sort of take more of a chance on moving forward. And then, you know, we'll see how it shakes out with each successive race.
One final thought here is on foreign policy. John Bolton has an interesting op-ed in the Journal's pages today. And essentially, I mean, John Bolton, of course, is a Trump staffer turned Trump antagonist. But his argument is that, at least on foreign policy, the two sides are sort of reverting to the mean. And he cites Afghanistan as an example. Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan was effectively what Trump's withdrawal from Afghanistan before that. And he points out that it has met with near total Republican rejection in Congress. And then he concludes with this line, Bill. He says, only 6 months into Mr. Biden's term, politics are reverting to familiar contours. Mr. Trump is increasingly visible only in the rearview mirror. unquote. And I wonder, Bill, what you make of that.
Well, I think he's right in terms of the Biden and Trump policy. Look, Donald Trump came in and, in fairness to him, campaigned on it, the idea that we need to withdraw from the world. He was, I would say there was a slight difference. You know, Obama wanted to get out of Afghanistan, and so does Biden, and so did Trump. Trump did hold up because of the generals saying, you know, it's too soon. He did listen to them in ways that Barack Obama did not in Iraq, for example. And then we saw the rise of ISIS, and that Joe Biden clearly has not in his withdrawal today. But I think he's right. Look, the larger story I take is Afghanistan is, I think, a tremendous mistake. My old boss, you know, George W. Bush, I was there, you know, during the wars then, and he just said, we're not going to run out of these places and leave these people hanging. And I think the Taliban is making it clear the consequences are going to be dire. You know, we have a program supposedly to help Afghans who translated for the army and so forth. Well, I read just this week, I think already one of these guys has been beheaded, was caught by the Taliban and beheaded. You read about Taliban forces coming into town. You know, they're taking over more and more territory and asking for a list of all the women from like 15 to 40. You saw, I think, the video clip of the Taliban just gunning down about two dozen members of Afghan special forces who were unarmed. So I think I think this is going to be very ugly. You know, Joe Biden has explicitly denied the parallel to Vietnam. But in Vietnam, you know, we sort of had 2 years between the peace deal and the fall of Saigon. I don't think we're going to even get that decent interval now. I think the Taliban are making it very clear. And look, let's go back to this from the other side. You know, from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda side, they have constantly been saying, America does not have the stomach for the long fight. Wait them out and they'll run the way they ran in Vietnam. That's been a constant theme. And I dread to think what the 9/11 anniversary is going to look like this year in Afghanistan before it. And finally, I'll say on that, apart from just being there, we have very modest number of troops in Afghanistan. I think it's 2,500 down to, you know, what the actual combat involvement is almost non-existent now. What they do bring to the Afghan government is sort of air support and other logistical support and intelligence. That's a very minimal commitment for a great power. We've got 80,000 troops between Korea and Japan, and I think we've got 35,000 in Germany. And I think those troops being there has stood the witness of time, that has made both those regions a lot safer for everyone. And I don't see how pulling out of Afghanistan does any of that for the United States.
Thank you, Bill and Manet. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.